All right. I had considered starting out today by doing the stuff on the economics of virtue and vice that I didn't get around to last time, but I decided that I've got enough stuff on Chinese law that we'll only do that if we get through all the Chinese stuff and then discuss that at the end, because I think it's fun, but not immediately relevant. So let me start by asking if any of you have questions on the reading you've just done about Chinese law. Next question, did any of you decide to read the Tang stuff instead of the book that's on reserve? There was a link in the syllabus to a book on Tang. The Tang is an earlier dynasty. The book we've got is basically about the last dynasty. The Tang dynasty is about 1,000 years earlier. I've just reread the Tang stuff, which was fun. And so I may be mixing up the two when I start describing things. And I was curious if anybody tried it, because it's all there very easily. I thought I'd run through sort of a very brief sketch of the legal history of China and then discuss some of the features of the law code. Yeah.
So, it seems like in the book, everything before what the book discusses is like this era of Confucianism. And I wonder if you would really think of that era as like being governed, other people of that era being governed by law. Because it seems like the book kind of doesn't think of it as law.
I would say it's very much law. It's a very elaborate legal code. The original Confucian people, presumably including Confucius, really thought people should be governed by morality rather than law.
Right.
But that isn't what actually happens. You end up with what's in fact a mix of Confucian and legalist ideas, and certainly by the Tang, you've got an elaborate law code with lists of penalties and lists of things that reduce or increase the penalties and so forth and so on. I'll be talking about that. So no, it's very much a law code. Yeah?
Yeah, I was thinking about I know Confucians are suspicious of law, like the rip of the year everyone. But I don't know how much they wanted to get rid of it. In looking through the law, I don't remember it. I remember suspicion about the law, that it's too some limits to inform it, but not necessarily something that says that it should be gotten rid of.
Well, one of the quotes, and I'm not sure how early it is, let me see if I can remember how it was put, is law for the commoners, morality for the elite. That sort of ordinary people were to be ruled by law, but the people at the top were supposed to be ruled by their own morality.
Which one is that one?
I don't know. That was a quote in the book on Tang Law that I've just been rereading a chunk of, and I don't remember whether it may have footnoted where it was from, but I don't remember.
Also, I think Confucius, at least in certain historical documents, was the minister of Fine.
I don't.
So that's kind of,
Don't know. But roughly, the sequence roughly is that you've got an early period from which we have very little information. There are some references suggesting that somebody compiles a law code 500 BC or such, but we don't really have it. You then have the development of what are at least later seen as two different schools of legal theory, legalist and Confucianist. And the problem with everything we know about that is that after the very early period, the Confucianists run things for the next 2,000 years. And that means that almost everything we know about the legalists is the account we get from their enemies, and therefore may not be reliable. And I gather there's some recent stuff, and I haven't really tracked it down and looked at it yet, where they actually dug up a bunch of documents from the brief period when there was a legalist dynasty, and they don't fit very well the description we have of legalism, but I'd like to look at that more carefully. But roughly the sequence is that the Confucian view is against equality before the law. The Confucian view is that the appropriate rules depend on your status and a bunch of other things. We'll get into more of that in detail. That having people be good is more important than having laws be good. Again, it's sort of an emphasis on morality. The legalists, in some ways, sound very much like sort of modern law and econ people in the sense of thinking of individuals as rational and such, of an economic model of behavior, but the conclusion is not laissez-faire, but strong regulatory government. working on those principles. They believe in equal laws for all, destroy factionalism and privilege. Sounds great. They believe on a government of laws, not men. They believe in principles of group responsibility, where if one member of the village does something bad, the village is punished. You could think of that as imposed, sort of like the Diyapane group in Somali culture in a way. They believe that if you have sufficiently severe punishments, you won't have to apply them because nobody will do anything that would get them, and therefore there's no cost to having severe punishments, and they'll deter all your crimes. They at least supposedly believe that ministers could be punished both for achieving too little and too much, meaning the minister says what he's going to do, and if he does a whole lot more than that, it shows he should have said so initially, and then unless he's obviously failed. The basic sequence is that the first successful empire in China is legalist. That one, there are a bunch of different kingdoms fighting each other. One of them, and again, this is the story as we get it. How true it is, we don't know. But the story is you have a bunch of kingdoms fighting each other. One of them adopts legalist principles and succeeds in defeating all the rest and uniting some sizable chunk of what's now China under its rule. It then burns the books, destroys all of the literature that represents things it doesn't agree with. The story I have heard, and again, I'm not sure I trust it, is that what destroys this dynasty very quickly, it's like 15 or 20 years after its triumph that it falls, is that there is a military unit which is told to go somewhere by a particular time and is unable to do so due to flooding or some similar problem. They conclude that since they've disobeyed their orders, they will all be executed on legalist principles of severe punishment. So they all rebel instead, and that eventually starts the rebellion that brings down the dynasty. It's a good story. It sort of is, you know, a moral, as it were, of the dangers of being too strict. But whether it's true, we do not know. But what we do know is that when things are put back together again under what becomes the Han Dynasty, which runs for about 300 years, it's roughly contemporary with the Roman Empire, loosely speaking. And the Han Dynasty is nominally Confucianist, but does not seem to carry it as far as the early Confucian thinkers would want. On the other hand, it does have all sorts of inequalities in the law that, for one thing, there are eight categories of special people. One of the categories is relatives of the emperor, pretty far out. Another category is descendants of the previous two imperial houses. You've got sequences of dynasties, not as far out, I think. And then there are some other punishments of sort of longtime servants of the emperor and various deserving people where we don't really know what made of them. And if you're in one of the eight categories, then if you commit a crime, most sorts of crimes, you get a lighter punishment than other people. You may be allowed to redeem the punishment, to make a money payment instead of getting beaten or exiled or whatever the punishment is and so forth. Then there are different inequalities by relationship. And the sort of really striking one is family. That families are extended families. They're very large extended families. Everybody in a family is connected to everybody else on two dimensions. One of them is how closely related you are, and that's put in terms of the mourning relationship. So the effect of how closely related you are is if somebody dies, how long you have to go into mourning for him. And the closer the relative, the longer. I think parents is like a year and a half or something. And the other is senior versus junior. So that senior versus junior, to begin with, is the descent tree, so that your uncle is senior to you, however old the two of you are. And similarly for a cousin who's one step up or one step down would be junior to you. At equal levels of the tree, it's by age. So your older brother is senior, your younger brother is junior. The basic rule is first that crimes against the person, the punishment is more severe if it's against a relative than against a stranger. Crimes against property, the punishment is less severe if it's against a relative than against a stranger. And I guess the theory is the property is in part the joint property of the family. I think I may have mentioned that some Islamic thinkers held that you could not commit the hard crime of theft by stealing from the government, so to speak, from the property of the Muslims, because you might think you had a claim to some of it. And similarly, if you have any reason to think you have a claim to property, that's supposed to get you out of the most serious category of theft in Islamic law. And so here, my guess, though I'm not sure, is that they're really thinking of the family as sort of a joint enterprise, and therefore it's not exactly stealing when you appropriate more of its stuff than you should have. The system of punishments, other than that, however, is that any punishment against a senior relative ramps the punishment up. Any offense against a junior relative ramps the punishment down. So that's a straight status system. And furthermore, that system is echoed in other hierarchies. So that you've got a monastery with people, with, I suppose, you know, monks and disciples or something. I don't know what the categories are, but a monastery which has a hierarchy of rank. You get the same rule for junior to senior in that as if it were junior to senior relative. Ditto for officials, that if you strike an official who's senior to you, and I'm not sure if this is any official or only in your hierarchy, you have a more severe punishment than if you'd struck an ordinary person. If you strike one who's junior, you have a less severe punishment. So a whole system in which the system of punishments is sort of echoing and reinforcing the hierarchy system, which I thought was sort of intriguing. A father may beat his son with no legal punishment, and that generally includes an adult son. For a son to strike his father is a capital offense. Relatives within certain degrees of relationship may conceal crimes committed by each other with no penalty. A relative within a certain level of relationship who tells his relative that the officials are coming to get him is not committed an offense. The way I like to put it is that one of the stories we tell about particularly terrible oppressive governments is that they try to make children inform on their parents. The Chinese system is exactly the opposite. To accuse your parent or a paternal grandparent of a crime that they have committed is a capital offense. In the Tang system, that's not true if the crime is treason, if the crime is a crime against the empire, but it's true for any lesser crime. And I believe, if I remember correctly from our book, that at some point in the Qing, they removed the exception. But I'm not sure if that's right. It's true of something else, at least, which I'll come to in a minute. So that's one of the systems of asymmetry. Husband can beat his wife. Wife can't. It's a crime for the wife to hit her husband. But it's not a crime for the family to conceal the fact that the wife hit her husband in order that she not be punished. Then there is a further system of status with three levels of status: privileged people, commoners, who are most of the population, and the inferior classes. And the inferior classes, the lowest is slaves, but there are two things that aren't quite commoners but are above slaves: the retainers and bondsmen, I think are the terms that I don't know enough about the details of what they are. But again, if you commit an offense up hierarchy, the punishment is more severe. A commoner who commits an offense against a privileged person, or a bondsman who commits an offense against a commoner. I think a slave who commits an offense against a commoner, I think it ramps up two steps in the punishment, and similarly in the other direction down. The killing your slave, you are not free to kill your slave. If you kill your slave without getting the government's permission to do so, and it's because the slave behaved badly, you get 100 blows of a heavy stick, which is one of the higher of the light punishments, so to speak. That is, you have the sets of punishments are blows with the light stick. These are canes of specified size. Blows with the heavy stick, penal servitude, life exile, and capital punishment. Each of these has divisions within it, but they're the five basic categories. And so if you kill your slave for a reason but without permission, you get 100 blows of a heavy stick. So the most serious of the lower set of punishments, as it were. If you do it with no cause, you get a year of penal servitude. It's still more serious. So you don't have unlimited rights with the guys against you, to your slave, but killing your slave is a lot less serious than killing anybody else, basically. Officials have the... In hard to say if it's a special privilege or just an opportunity that other people don't have, and that is that they can replace a punishment by giving up an office. So if the official is convicted of a crime, which he would be exiled for some length of time or one of these other serious punishments, he can surrender his office, where how big a punishment he gets to replace depends on the office. So you may have a case where his office is worth more than the punishment, and in that case he's allowed to redeem the punishment with money instead. Or you can have a case where the office is worth less than the punishment and he gives up the office and pays some money, or gives up the office plus something else he's got. It's more elaborate than I'm making it sound. And it sounds as though in some cases you can give up not only your present office, but past offices. I'm not sure in what sense you have credit for past offices, but yes.
I think that might be an honor and shame thing going on, so previous titles have some honor to them.
It might well be, because there's a comment, I think, that if I've got it right, in addition to offices, you sometimes have honorary positions, and you can add those to what you're giving up as well. But all of this stuff, in most cases, you're giving it up for a year. And you then return, but you're a step, or in some cases, two steps down in rank, as it were. So it's a combination of sort of a temporary disfranchisement plus a permanent reduction in rank. So in a sense, you might think of that as being as special privileges of officials, or you might just say, well, anybody can give up an office. You have to have an office in order to give one up, and most people don't. There is then a set of rules on age, where very young and very old people receive lighter punishments. And at least the theories, this is all Tang that I'm giving you, but it's pretty similar. There's a comment in the Tang thing that about 40% of the Qing code, which is the code that the book that you've got is about, comes out of the Tang code. So it's the Tang are the first people, as far as you can tell, who really put together a full-scale legal code, a sizable chunk of which has survived. And there certainly was legal code of some sort under the Han, but we don't know much about it. And then everybody after the Tang copies the previous dynasty's code and makes changes. So the Tang is about 1,000 years earlier. The Tang are 600-something to 900-something, whereas the Qing, which is the final dynasty, the Manchu, who are the ones the book is mostly about, basically are through the end of the 19th century. So it's about 1,000-year separation, but the law code largely carries down. Let me go back a bit, actually, because I should have said there was some other interesting stuff about the Tang that I should have gone through and didn't here. For one thing, the Tang... Do people know about the examination system? This is one of the weird and interesting features of Chinese culture, and it seems to date in its full-scale version to the Tang period, as then carried all the way through. Anybody except a member of the very bottom categories can take the exams, and the exams then give you office. So if you are a very bright kid in a village in China, the other villagers chip together to make sure you don't have to work so you can spend full time studying the classics and reading and calligraphy and all sorts of stuff like that in order that you can then take the exams, and if you do really well, you will be a minor official and you'll be able to do to in various ways benefit your village and your relatives and such. Your village may largely be your relatives, in fact, and so forth. If you do very well in the exam, you end up as a district magistrate, which means that you are the mayor, chief of police, judge for some hundreds of thousands of people, maybe more than that. And if you do really well in the exam, you get to join the censorate, which is the people who are watching the district magistrates. So that they literally have a whole department of government, which consists, as far as I can tell, of the highest IQ people, at least in theory. That is, because one of the weird things about the exam is it's not an exam on being a district magistrate. It's an exam on being able to compose poetry, on having good calligraphy, on being fully familiar with the classic works of Chinese literature, on that kind of stuff. And so, as I say, you might think of it as an IQ test, I'm not sure. But you then join the censorate, which is the department of the government, which has people going around investigating the possibility that government officials have been corrupt in various ways and reporting that they have been. So that, yeah?
Can you
So even if you get to those high positions, can the village still benefit?
Well, that's an interesting question. The magistrate pretty clearly is never magistrate over his own area. On the other hand, I presume that the magistrate sometimes comes home for vacation or, you know, he's got family somewhere. Maybe they go along with him. So I don't know how much. And I think I would guess more likely for minor officials. That one of the things that I think is going on in a number of features of this system is the problem of how you keep a centralized system from turning into feudalism. Because if you look at Chinese history, what you have is a dynasty runs things for a few hundred years. Then there's some kind of internal conflict. Then things break down and there's really no single government over it. And then eventually another dynasty rises. And if you're imagining this system, you've given this district magistrate enormous power. He's sort of the whole government, as it were, in his area. You might worry that he's going to turn into a feudal lord after a while. And how do you prevent that? One way you prevent that is he's only allowed to stay in one district for, I think, a total of 3 years. So you keep moving him around. Another way is he's not allowed to be in the district that his own family is in. Another way is he's not allowed to marry anybody from his district, because you can make marital alliances in various political systems. And another way, at least the Tang book suggests, is that you have a legal code which specifies punishments very precisely so that he doesn't have very much discretion, which reduces his ability to reward or punish people he does or doesn't like. And they don't carry it quite that far, but I think that's the implication of what's going on. The Ottomans had the same problem. The Ottoman Empire, people know anything about the Ottoman Empire. They're basically what ended about 1900, roughly, and they were Turkey and a whole lot of the rest of the Islamic world for a while. And the Ottoman system seems to have gone as follows. The Ottomans are fighting some place that they want to conquer and make part of the Ottoman Empire. And the surrender terms are as follows. If you surrender, we won't kill you. You being the rulers, the top people in the area. In fact, you get to keep being a rich, high, important person. You just don't do it where you are. We'll move you over to the other side of the empire. Give you a position where you're our official in charge of somebody else at the empire. You live well. You're in luxury. You're powerful. But you've got no local support, no local commands. It's all dependent on the sultan, so you'd better be loyal. And since you know the terrible things don't happen, you're more willing to surrender when it looks like you're losing our invasion. So that was a rather elegant solution, but the same essential problem. And I don't think they moved them around as far as I know. On the other hand, they were much more nearly foreigners in the area and therefore presumably have a harder time building up their own support. So that's the exam system. Some people have suggested that the reason that people of East Asian descent have on average higher IQs than people of European descent, which is the thing that people don't usually talk about when they're discussing racial differences, is that the Chinese civil service system for 1400 years was selecting very smart people and making them important people in a polygynous society in which being an important male might mean having lots of children. We're not sure if this is true, but it's an interesting theory for people who believe that non-deliberate selective breeding in human populations actually mattered. Yeah?
It seems like then you have to compare that to other East Asian regions.
Yes. Well, that depends on how... China is an awful lot of East Asia at various parts of the time, right. And there's a lot of... It would be nice to know. I don't know enough about Korea would be another... be a fairly separate one, and Vietnam a fairly separate one, although... a lot of this stuff is under Chinese influence. So, yes, that would be an interesting experiment. But the usual claim is just made of East Asian populations in general. I wonder, because it may also be true of American Indians, and they left East Asia before their Chinese examination system was created. So that would be evidence against that explanation, at least. But anyway, so... but again, it was a weird system. It's where our civil service system, I think, was originally modeled on. The idea of formal neutral exams. I remember one person discussing, I'm not sure which dynasty, but who claimed that the system really started working when they switched to blind grading of the exams. That at one point it was really a nepotism system, that those in power controlled the exams and they made sure that their relatives did well in the exams. And then some dynasty with sort of strong views on the subject introduced very elaborate procedures for blind grading. So if I remember correctly, I think the graders are not actually reading the paper written by the exam student. I think there's an intermediate person who has to copy the paper down and then hand it to the grader so that the original one can't, by his handwriting, signal who he is. I think that's right. And then supposedly the system started really working at that point for takeoff. Now, whether the story is true, I don't know, but it's a neat story, and it could well be true. And it reminds me a bit of the Athenian stuff about the elaborate procedures to prevent the bribing of jurors. That it's clear that if you look in the Athenian book that you were reading, they were worried about the fact that you would bribe jurors, and so they have elaborate procedures to make sure that not until the very last minute do you know which person is going to be a jury, juror in which case. So that was sort of neat as well. Anyway, let me go back to... one of the things, by the way, this is a digression that I was going to say at the beginning but didn't, in reading that book that you might notice is its defensive tone. That is to say, and this is a pattern that I think you're going to notice in a bunch of things. I noticed it in the first chapter of the Gypsy book, but the people who are writing the book about China obviously, on the whole, sort of admire and are sympathetic to the Chinese civilization. That's why they spend their life studying it. And then they're worried that all the people reading the book will think of China as a horrible place where they torture people and are bad in this way and are bad in this way and so forth and so on. And so there's a strong tendency to say, well, yes, it's true that there are all these offenses for which the punishment was capital. But most of them didn't really get executed through this elaborate procedure that they run through of strangulation after the assizes, which usually means you never get strangulated at all. And they have some guesses how many people were, and they say, unlike the Bloody Code in England, where they executed everybody, but of course, if you then read the people who write about the Bloody Code in England, they didn't execute everybody either. The figures suggest that of the people who were charged with capital felonies in a set of cases in England, about, I think, 16% actually got hanged. And the Gypsy one, it's pretty clear that at least the editor of the book is really worried that you'll think Gypsy people are dirty and steal chickens and you do all sort of terrible things and sort of goes out of his way to try to defend them. It's a very natural bias that you're writing. I mean, I have the same bias for my Icelanders, that if you're writing about a society you like it, you're interested in it, you know much more about it than your readers, and you're probably right that they've got some incorrect, simplified views of it, but it also means there's a certain amount of distortion, I think. And the funniest bit, at least to me, was the fact that that Body and Norris writing about China take for granted the views about 18th century England that correspond to the views about China that they're objecting to, which I thought was amusing. All right, let me run through. All right, let me go back, actually, because I noticed I didn't have it in my outline, and I should. I think it's some stuff you're just supposed to have read, and I hope you read it, because it's interesting. The execution, the system of punishments. So the first level of punishments is beating with a stick of a given size a certain number of blows. Only if you look at the Qing system, by the Qing system, the number isn't really the number. They've got these conversion factors. I don't remember what the numbers are, but it's something like being sentenced to 100 blows means you get 60 blows. And being sentenced to 20 blows means you get 12 blows, and so forth and so on. And it's not entirely clear why, I think. But this is true of other things. And the place where it's most striking is the capital offenses. Because there are four ordinary capital punishments. They are strangulation before the assizes and decapitation before the assizes. Strangulation after the assizes and decapitation after the assizes. Now, why do you care whether they strangle you or cut your head off? And the answer, apparently, is that there are negative post-mortem consequences to being cut in pieces. That I'm not sure if your body can't reassemble in the afterlife, but something like that. So that for essentially religious reasons, it's considered worse to be killed in one way than the other. But the assizes are the big one. Because being decapitated or strangled before the assizes means to actually cut your head off or strangle you. After the assizes, it means you're sent, I think, to Peking. And you wait for the assizes, which happen once a year. And when they happen, a sheet of paper is drawn up with the names of all of the people who are awaiting execution. And the emperor takes a brush and draws a circle on that sheet of paper. And it's not entirely clear whether it's the people inside the circle or outside the circle who get executed, but it's only one of those two groups. And the numbers seem to suggest that the larger number are the ones who aren't getting executed. So it's presumably, I assume this is going back to a point at which you assume that the emperor in his wisdom was actually looking at cases and deciding, and that by this time it's become a magical process in which the emperor sort of will magically know who to put where in the page. So you would think of people who are drawing up the sheet of paper who are really controlling it. So then if you're on the lucky side of the circle, you go back to prison. And I think that if you have a not too serious capital offense, if you survive twice, they commute it down to a lesser punishment. And I think for the most serious capital offenses, you may have to survive it like 8 times or 10 times before they commute it down to a lesser punishment. So it's an elaborate procedure. And one of the things I want to get to in a little bit, because it's sort of interesting, is if we have any guess as to why they did it that way. But the basic logic of it is that you have a capital punishment that isn't really capital. Now, there is one other capital punishment in addition to this, which is the one that sometimes gets referred to as the death of 1,000 cuts. And that's a sort of, you're not only being killed, you're being killed pretty painfully. You're being sort of tied up and cut in bits. And that's for really, really serious offenses. Which gets to the question of what offenses are more serious than others.
So there was also some talk about use of castration, cutting off your nose.
That's all early. That's all pre-Han. I'm pretty sure that by the Han, I think they've abolished all of that. I don't swear it is, but I think that's right. That those are things recorded from the, I think that's right, from the early ones. I could be wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong. That's my memory of it, at least, about those things. But there is a distinction between penal servitude and exile. And within each of these, penal servitude is, I think, for 1, 2, or 3 years. And exile is to one of several different distances from your home area. And there are some worse versions of it. I think there's a version in which you're essentially becoming a slave of a military garrison somewhere on the border. And there's exile to a malarious region or a sick region or something. So that it's more complicated than I'm describing, right? Because I've just been looking at the Tang, and it may have gotten more complicated by Qing times. But roughly speaking, the categories are blows of the light stick, blows of the heavy stick, penal servitude, life exile, and capital punishment, with degrees within these. And in theory, one of the things that shows how merciful the law code is, at least by Qing times, is that when they push it up for some reason, such as you're attacking a senior relative, they push it up by a degree within a category, and when they push it down by a category. So that I think it's the case that if you normally would have been sentenced to 1 year's penal servitude, and you've done, there's something that makes it worse, you get 2 years. And if there's something better, it goes down from penal servitude to blows and the heavy stick. I think that's the theory, at least. We'll be seeing a good deal more of it in detail because you're going to be reading your cases. I hope you have all noticed that the syllabus has got a list of which pages of the book each of you is supposed to read, so that it's set up so that every case is getting read by 2 people. And hopefully that'll be enough of a background so we can discuss them interestingly for our next class. So part of what intrigues you about all of these things is trying to make sense of them and trying to figure out why they do them in the way they do. And in the case of all of them, I think, there are 2 basic alternative theories, one of which might be true, but I don't find very interesting, and one of which I find interesting, but might not be true. And the less interesting one goes under the general heading of culture. The less interesting one says, is the reason they do this, the reason that it is worse to attack a senior relative is that Confucian culture believes in the importance of family and respect for family and a bunch of stuff like that. And then my thing is, well, that's interesting. Why? And the reason, well, I'll run through, because there are, if you try to look at the features of the system, there are some features that are hard to explain as having a function. And one is tempted to say, well, those come out of sort of philosophy, religion, that kind of stuff. And then there are other features where you can at least plausibly explain them as functional. And as I say, I think part of the interest and puzzle of this kind of thing is that tension and trying, sort of my strategy is if I can possibly find a function for it, I'll find a function for it, but I could easily be wrong in some of these. So I think the family one is pretty easy to understand. that I think what's going on here, and now I'm going to go up to the Qing, because I don't know the figures for the Tang, but by the Qing dynasty, you've got a population of more than 100 million people, possibly by the end of it, 200 or 300 million people. You've got this small bureaucracy of elite scholar officials, and there is no way that one magistrate can deal with as many cases as you would expect to arise in a population of half a million people. All right. So how do you do it? You set up a system in which most of the job of controlling people is subcontracted to other institutions. And the main institution for doing this is the extended family. So my reading of what's going on, and I may be wrong, is that you've got is that a central purpose of the set of odd rules about the family is to maintain the hierarchical authority within the family. So your father can beat you without penalty because that's how he makes you behave. You don't get hit back. I'll cut your head off. Your senior relatives can't commit crimes against you without penalty, but it's lesser penalty than if you commit crimes against them. And you can't use the threat to tell the officials about the illegal things your father has done, because people in society do illegal things from time to time, in order to weaken your father's authority over you, because it's illegal to tell the officials about illegal things your father has done. That's my reading of what's going on. I'm not sure it's right, but it makes an interesting and, I think, plausible story. And then you've got other hierarchies. You've got the hierarchy in the monastery. You're doing the same thing. You've got trade guilds, which I know less about, but which are presumably doing something similar and so forth. So all of that makes sense. And a general pattern of making the legal system unpleasant to deal with makes sense, because then only when you really have to do you get involved in it. And in general, it's pretty clearly seen as a criminal system in which the affairs among people are... Now, let me qualify this. The book you're reading believes that there is essentially nothing we would think of as an equivalent of contract law, tort law, etc. There is apparently some later scholarship by people who disagree with this, and I haven't yet read it, so I don't know how good their evidence is. But at least the stuff we're looking at, it looks as though what the courts are interested in are what we would think of as crimes. And they, therefore, don't have to deal with all of the "he cheated me and I want the court to do something about" kind of cases. So that reduces it. And even for crimes, if you confess to your crime before there's a written accusation, you get let off, at least in some cases entirely, depending on the form of the crime. In some cases, you're entirely exempt. In some cases, part of the punishment is reduced. If several people commit a crime and one of them turns the others in, he gets let off. If you are essentially evading punishment and turn yourself in, you get a lighter punishment. So there are a bunch of things along those lines which are going to hopefully make the work to be done by the court less. False accusations, at least in the Tang Code, if you accuse somebody of a crime and it has turned out he is innocent, you get the punishment he would have gotten if he had been convicted. In the Qing Code, at least, it may occur to you with a really unpleasant criminal system that a way of getting somebody you don't like is to accuse them of something. But then that entangles you in the system, which you don't want, because witnesses can be tortured too. So you accuse them anonymously, except that it's illegal, at least by Qing times, to read anonymous accusations for the officials. So again, it looks as though they're trying to cover that base as well. And my memory of it is that it's illegal to read anonymous accusations except of treason initially, and then they remove the exception later. And they're a fair note. Yo?
So when you say when somebody accuses and the case fails, they get the punishment, but officials are exempt from that, or is it just...
Don't know. But officials can be punished for doing things wrong. There are a whole lot of things where if the official breaks the rule, he gets 100 months of the heavy stick. How much that's enforced, you don't know. But certainly in principles, there were a lot of rules controlling the officials as well. Let me go back to the sort of question of whether it's culture or function with regard to some specific features. I like to claim that human beings are equipped with very good pattern recognition software, so good that we can even see patterns that aren't there. And one way of interpreting Chinese law and Chinese culture is that it's pattern recognition gone crazy. Because, for example, the whole system is really fond of the number five. There are five elements. All right. In classical European civilization, there are four elements: earth, air, fire, and water. In Chinese, there are five elements, which are earth, fire, water, wood, and metal. There are five directions: north, south, east, west, and central. There are five colors. Which colors count as five? I don't know. Everything is either yin or yang, and there are five categories of things that are yin and five categories of things that are yang. There are five categories of punishments. Each of the first three kinds of punishment has five subcategories within it, and the last two add up to five, three and two. How does this matter? How does this offer possible explanation for some of this stuff? Because all of this, if you think about seeing patterns, all of this connects with the idea that there's sort of a link between natural and human affairs, which means that if you have too much injustice, there are going to be droughts and floods and things. Consequently, that if there are droughts and floods, it might really be prudent for the emperor to declare an amnesty, because it sort of looks like he's punishing people too much, and nature has rebelled against it. And you have all of these things where you're supposed to execute people, but there's at least half the year when you can't. Because execution turns out to be yin. And two seasons of the year are yin, and two seasons of the year are yang, and you've got to do it in the yin seasons. You know, you've seen these famous, the diagram of yin and yang. It's sort of some kind of a division of the of everything, which I don't understand it very well. There are various other days when you can't execute people for other reasons, but I think the estimate may have been down to 66 days in the year when you can execute people now. It doesn't matter that much. I mean, you can always hold them for a week and then execute them, but it's sort of weird. But think about the before and after the assizes in a system where there has to be a balance. So you've killed somebody. There's got to be a balance of a life for a life. We actually don't want to execute you. So we'll sort of nominally execute you. We will sentence you to strangulation after the assizes and then let you off. So I think one possible way, not the only way, but one possible way of reading all of that is that it's almost like playing games with God, if that makes sense. Only it's not exactly God. It's not seen, I think, as God so much as the natural balance. And similarly, the argument can be made that if you have confessed your crime and returned what you stole, you've restored the natural balance, so there's no need to punish you to restore it. There's an odd bit in the law where a group of people have committed a crime for which there's a capital sentence. They're caught and convicted. One of them dies. The others now don't have to be executed. One life has paid the debt. Nature is in balance again. So they get a non-capital sentence, get commuted to a non-capital sentence. So whether that's right, I don't know. That is, all of these one would like to think of, see if one could think up functional explanations as well. But at least a lot of it is seen within the system in those terms. And I suspect that a reasonably skeptical observer of our society could maybe find analogous things, could maybe find things we do because they somehow fit our vision of the universe and not because they make sense. I guess in a way, it's not quite the same thing. But if you think about the word pollution, all right, is it an inherently bad thing for water to be warmer? Say for a river to be 2 degrees warmer than it used to be. Is that an evil thing? Do we know that this is terrible? It's thermal pollution.
Absolutely.
Might be, it might not be.
Well, I mean, some of the organisms living in the river will be negatively affected.
Yeah, and other organisms positively, and there are other organisms that lived in slightly warmer rivers, or that did well in the river a little bit later in the year when it got warmer. My point is, it might be bad, but calling it thermal pollution short circuits that question. All right? Pollution is originally a religious concept, as far as I can tell. Just as I'm pretty sure that masturbation used to be referred to as pollution. You're polluting yourself somehow or other. And that in general, there is a sense in which we impose normative things on the natural world. Think about the way we use the word natural. That's a good one, all right? In our civilization at the moment, at the moment, saying something natural is a compliment. Well, you know, measles is natural, flu is natural, antibiotics are unnatural, blood transfusions are unnatural, and yet we still think of natural foods. There aren't any natural foods, pretty much. Salt is a natural food, right? Almost everything we eat, certainly every plant we eat, every important plant crop, is the result of human selective breeding over long periods of time. All right, maize is bred up in Central America for like 2,000 years or something from some kind of a weed that we wouldn't recognize as a food. The grains are bred up. Some of these may be unintentional. That is, in some cases, it may be a matter of hunter-gatherers, and they gather the biggest seeds, and then those grow and so forth. But for whatever reason, potatoes are the production of agricultural technology by in the central in the Andes, long pre-Columbian, and yet we think of natural as good, or organic is another one of those words where you've got words which are linked somehow to feel-good feelings in our culture. Yeah.
But progress be another one then.
Yeah.
Everything grows.
Although progress is a little complicated, you could argue that progress. It's not that we believe progress is good, that we only define good change as progress. One use of progress. If you say, I'm making progress on that project, you mean you're getting further along in it. And if you say, what progress did I make? I made a regress. I remember the comment of a certain fantasy writer or somewhere or other. She said that, you know, she'd written 12 chapters this week, but unfortunately they're all chapter one. So that's, you know, one step forward, one step back, one step forward, one step back. As she rewrites the chapter.
I think growth has a positive connotation.
Yeah, probably right, and that's not as clear. That's right. The growth of a tumor is not a great thing, right? But it's growth. Yeah. But I think there are lots of examples like that where we link a sort of a symbolic or, emotionally speaking, a religious feeling to it. And I think natural is probably the clearest. You say, why do people not want species to become extinct? Now, you can fudge up arguments, maybe even good arguments, but that isn't what's going on. If you say, why is it a bad thing if there are no more spotted owls? The reason that people react that way is not that they have figured out why the spotted owl is useful to human beings. It's because they think a universe, sort of a natural universe as it is good. That's the sort of gut-level feeling. And I'm not sure if it has much more serious basis than the feeling that there's a balance of nature and so forth. Anyway, yeah, organic, the term organic always irritates me because, of course, in the literal sense, again, salt is the only inorganic food I know of, right? I mean, organic has a meaning in chemistry, and it's certain sorts of chemicals which are made up of carbon and hydrogen mostly, and all of our foods except for sodium chloride, I guess, is the only one we eat very often, meet that category, but organic sounds good, and so it's used to mean grown in particular ways that some people approve of, with less use of pesticides and things of that sort. And, yeah?
I was going to say the culture, looking at ascribing culture as a source of these laws has also another problem, especially in Chinese law. And that's all the various philosophies that are sometimes very contradictory to each other, but can sort of be hobbled together. So, like, Taoist, functional.
So, how different, as you think about. The big three, I would have said, were Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. That those have been the major religions in China. And how would any of them disagree about this balance of nature stuff?
I think they might have different understandings of what are things like natural order, or natural balance, or cosmic balance. And I mean, I think they all have some kind of understanding of it, from my understanding of these. But I know that Confucian and Buddhist conflict, Taoism, I don't really know too much about.
Yeah.
And so, when you're looking at all these laws, and you're talking about, or when you're talking about something like the yin yang and that kind of thing, it seems like it would just be hard to ascribe them to from various sources, because you've got so many to choose from to start with, and then you've got a schedule of evidence as to why it comes from here rather than this.
But one of the things I'd like to know is whether if you assembled a 10th century or 12th century Confucian Taoist and Buddhist and had a conversation with us, whether they would all seem to us more similar to each other than different.
Yeah, I think the Neo-Confucian part of Chinese history, being Song, that was an attempt at trying to synthesize. But at the same time, you've still got a kind of hierarchy going on where I think Confucian ideas were, ethics were held a central spot. And then after you carved out that area, then you can talk about kind of more metaphysical principles and maybe a sort of Buddhist or even Taoist way. So in that, if you took someone from there, I forget when the song was, if you take someone from there then and introduce them to us, you know, as 21st century representatives, it might seem that way. But I think you look at the classical forms of all these, there were real conflicts. And I think that's why if you look within Confucian, modern Confucian, contemporary Confucian studies, there's some scholars that say New Confucianism is a different animal than classical Confucianism.
Yeah, but, you know, they can be, right, you know, all Chinese look alike to us, and all of us look alike to them. There's a sense in which it might be that there are differences significant within the group, but that there's enough common features to the civilization so that from our standpoint, they all are fairly far on one side or another. Well, I'm perfectly happy anytime we can come up with functional explanation for something. I just think that it's only fair to give the other side of the story, as it were, because it's a possible account of what's going on. Let me give you one example, which is one of the ones that I found particularly hard to explain away. And that is that if you are a district magistrate and your parent dies, the mourning period is 27 months. During this period, you cannot function as a district magistrate. You cannot have intercourse with your wife. That's part of mourning. I don't know what all the list of other things are you can't do, but you would think that you don't really want to have, you know, these scarce officials who are running your empire suddenly, sort of randomly, taken off the map for 27 months. And that looks as though it's somehow coming out of some sort of a religious belief of the obligations to parents, and I don't know, but that's and of course the one which is in some sense a related question, I guess, is why have the civil service system the way it does at all? That is, why don't you have mainly tests on do you know the law, do you know how to administer things, why do you care whether your district magistrate is skilled in poetry? And I don't know. Now maybe you're trying to create a elite loyal to itself. That is, maybe the idea is a common culture. If you think about subgroups that somehow, and maybe the idea is that all of these people who have been brought up in this philosophy and this body of literature and so forth, if you think about science fiction fans, say they have something in common with each other and other groups within our society who have shit. One of the books I want somebody to write is a book called Little Worlds. And the idea is that a modern society like ours is really made up of a whole lot of tiny worlds, much more human-scale worlds. So that my people who do historical recreation for the Middle Ages and the Renaissance is one little world. And the mineral collecting that my wife's parents did is a little world. And the serious bridge playing that my sister and her husband do is a world. And the horse stuff that my sister does is a world. And international folk dancing that my wife used to do is a world. And libertarianism is a world. And in some ways, it's a very highly desirable arrangement, because one of the things wrong with the modern society is that people want to matter. And if your reference group is 300 million Americans, you've got to be really extraordinary for anybody else to notice you, so to speak, in that context. If your reference group is a few thousand people who share some interest with you, though, and you're, you know, a reasonably confident, hardworking, responsible member of the group, by the time you've been in it a while, you're visible, you're significant, maybe you're somebody important. So in that sense, it seems to me it's a sensible adaptation, as it were, to the conditions of modern life to form these sort of subcommunities. But anyway, going back to the Chinese, maybe part of what's going on is that you're trying to make the cultured gentlemen be their own subcommunity so that they'll be loyal to each other rather than be loyal to the people they're ruling or to some other, to the military or to some other faction. Let's see, other things I was going to look at. I think I've more or less run through the ones that had occurred to me where it sort of looks as though what's going on might be cultural things driving the law rather than functions driving the law. And some of them you can explain either way. That is the business about the fact that the false accusation, the accuser gets a punishment. It'll make a certain amount of sense if you don't want false accusations. The business about if you turn yourself in, we won't punish you, or we punish you more lightly. Well, we do that too to varying degrees. And, you know, it has some unfortunate consequences. I think one of the things that, as far as I can tell, is happening in our system is that if the defendant insists he's innocent at sentencing, I think he gets a higher sentence than if he doesn't. I don't think that's legally supposed to be true, but my impression is that the judge wants you to show remorse. And you can't show remorse for something you didn't do. And therefore, if you want to persuade the judge that you're on the road to being a good citizen again, you have to confess and say, I'm terribly sorry, Your Honor, it was a great mistake and I will never do it again, rather than saying, I didn't do this, why are you framing me? So that's, in a sense, the other side of that same pattern. And certainly rewarding people for turning in their co-criminals makes a lot of sense, and we do it all the time. You know, it's not clear. Again, it has problems because it may well mean that of the two criminals, you end up convicting the accessory and letting off the principal because the principal was the one who had enough sense to turn in the accessory and claim he was guilty. So there are lots of potential problems as well, but a lot of this stuff does make sense. Let me go back, though, to one of the ones which I was offering an explanation in the religion culture, but I want to consider an alternative explanation. And that's these bogus executions, that is, these bogus capital punishments. Because an alternative way of looking at it is that maybe they think that the people they are trying to deter are not very sophisticated. And so maybe what they say is, we don't really want to execute all those people. But if we say we're going to execute someone, and you don't see him for another 2 years, you're going to assume he was executed, and therefore you're not going to commit crimes. So maybe it's a way of getting deterrence on the cheap. And this goes back, in a way, to what I was discussing about 18th century England, where you convict somebody of sheep stealing, you sentence him to hang by the neck until dead, and then you send him home and tell him not to do it again. So that might be in the same category. You think you can have sort of the pretense of a very serious punishment to some extent can substitute for the real very serious punishment. And again, I'm not sure that's what's happening, but that might be what's happening. So I think it's a possibility worth looking at. I'm just making sure this is actually running, which it is, because I think I lost part of my earlier class for unknown reasons. All right, something else I wanted to run through, which I think is intriguing, and again, I don't know whether on which explanation it is the Ten Abominations. And this is, again, from the Tang source, so like most of this stuff carries through. And the Ten Abominations are 10 categories of crime which are treated especially harshly. And part of especially harshly means that when there's an amnesty, it's not covered. That the Tang figures suggest that on average there's an amnesty about every 2 years, which means that 3 years penal servitude may well mean 1 or 2 years penal servitude. An amnesty sometimes means for some people that you're sent home. Sometimes it means that you're reduced, have a reduced sentence. The 10 abominations amnesties don't apply to. What are the 10 abominations? Well, they include incest. They include lack of filial piety. They do not include murder. They do include, however, killing 3 members of one family. That's a very serious offense. The 2 worst are rebellion and great sedition. And rebellion means more or less what it says, and great sedition is trying to destroy the tombs of the emperor's family, the temples of the emperor's, various things which are sort of indirect attacks on the emperor. And both of those not only are you executed, everybody involved is executed, all their close relatives are executed, and the not-so-close relatives are sent into slavery or into life exile or stuff like that. So you're basically destroying the whole family. Those are really big ones. Also, I think it's the case that generally for the abominations, you don't get to make a money payment as an exchange in exchange for the punishment, which sometimes under some circumstances you're allowed to do otherwise. Making a mistake in serving the emperor is one of the great abominations. That includes getting the prescription for his medicine wrong. It includes building a boat he's going to give on that isn't strong enough, which presumably leaks or sinks or something. And if you do it by mistake, it's a great abomination. If you do it deliberately, it counts as plotting rebellion, and so is a top-level great abomination. So it's, again, interesting to see what are the things that are seen as particularly horrible. There's one magical thing. There's one of the categories, I forget, which includes making some kind of poison, which is supposedly made out of insects in some odd kind of way. It's not clear if this is real or superstition, but it's associated with sort of black magic kinds of stuff and therefore is a very serious offense. Furthermore, there are various contexts in which you have status immunity of some sort, such as being a relative of the emperor, or being an official who can trade in your office, not if it's a great abomination. So these are sort of, in some sense, a set of offenses which, for one reason or other, they take really seriously. And that struck me as an interesting list. And if you read the Tang book, which you can nicely link to the syllabus, somewhere about halfway through the reading, I suggested you have a list of great abominations and then a discussion afterwards of what classified them to be, which is also sort of interesting. Age affects punishment. I don't know if I mentioned that or not, but basically you've got two grades below and two grades above. I remember, I think it's like 60 and 70 or 60 and 80 something are the high ages, where the higher up you are in the age, the more willing they are to let you give money instead of suffering the punishment, and the lower the punishment you get. Also, the lower in the age at the young end. And it seems the explanation I saw in the Tang discussion was that young people and old people don't know, really aren't very smart, sort of. They think of old people as going senile, I'm not sure. But I'm not sure if it's that or if it's respect for age, but then why youth or whatever. But that struck me as an intriguing subject that was covered there. Other things worth mentioning, there is, in the Tang, as in the Qing you're reading about, you have a law code which is designed to be a complete mapping of offense to punishment, but doesn't succeed in doing that. That is to say, it's a very detailed list describing an offense in considerable detail, and this is the punishment. But then there are at least two and maybe three ways in which it doesn't fit that. One of them is that you're allowed to determine punishments by analogy. And this consists either of saying, this offense doesn't actually, we can't find it anywhere in the law book, but it's very much like that more serious offense. So we will use the rule from that serious offense and then ramp it down to allow for it being less serious, or in the other direction, it's very much like that less serious offense and we'll allow for that one and ramp it up. And there are some examples, again, in the Tang, in the book that's on the Tang law code, there are examples of doing both of those things. So that's one out. Second out is doing what ought not to be done. There is a blank statute which says you can be found, that's blank like a bank check, that you can be found guilty of doing something that they really ought to have had a law against so they didn't get around to it. However, the limit on that is low-end punishments. That's either 40 or 80 blows of the light stick, so it's two of the lowest punishments that the magistrate can impose on you. And in the Qing version, I didn't see this mentioned in the Tang version, there's also an offense of disobeying an imperial order where it doesn't have to be an order the emperor ever actually made. It could just be an order he would have made if he'd known about the subject. And that one, I think, does not have the limit of the low punishment, but I have to go back to the book and check because it wasn't in what I just reread. So that means that you on the one hand, are trying to fit it all into this elaborate code, but then where you can't, you've got different ways of dealing with things that you know you want to do something about, but you don't know how to fit into the code. And those are the three such solutions that I know about. Other things of interest? Oh, yes. In both, I think all the way from the Tang up, you've got a fairly elaborate system of review of the decisions of the magistrate. So that the only punishments the magistrate can impose without any further authority are the beating punishments, light stick or heavy stick. For the next level up, which is penal servitude, it gets, in effect, automatically appealed one level up to his superiors who have to approve it. For the life exile, I think it gets appealed two levels up, and then the execution, as I said, ultimately is going, in effect, in theory, to the emperor before it can happen. So that the magistrate, theoretically, is limited on his own authority to fairly low-level punishments. And one of the cases we'll be looking at for next time is a case involving ways in which magistrates are essentially trying to evade the supervision and eventually getting caught and getting rather negative responses for doing that. I think I may have now covered everything about Chinese law that was in my outline for what I was going to cover today, which I wasn't sure I was going to get through. So do you have things you would like to discuss about it? If not, I will go on to tell you about the economics of vice and virtue. Yes? No? Stuff about Chinese law? Economics of vice and virtue starts out with the following true story. When I was teaching at UCL economics department a very long time ago, and there was a workshop by a visiting speaker who was arguing against basically the economic view of crime. And he told the following story. Two men sit down in a bar, and they drink a bit, and they get into an argument about football teams. And when it's over, one of them is lying there dead on the floor, and the other is standing there with a broken beer bottle in his hand and a dazed expression on his face saying, "What have I done?" And the guy says, clearly this was not rational behavior. He regressed it as soon as it happened, so you can't deter that with punishment. And I jump up on one side of the room, and Errol Thompson jumps up on the other side of the room, and we say more or less in unison, of course it's rational behavior, it's a doomsday machine going off. We probably didn't really use the same words, but this is the way I've filtered this through 30 years of memory to something like that. What's going on? People know what a doomsday machine is? A doomsday machine is a stylized version of mutual assured destruction. It was somebody who wrote a book on thermonuclear war and got very unpopular for actually trying to think about the subject. Imagine the following arrangement. You get a bunch of very, very dirty hydrogen bombs. They're supposed to be coated with cobalt, which apparently transmutes into something very radioactive when you blow it up. So dirty that if you set up all of them, it'll sterilize the Earth, kill all human life on Earth at least. You don't bother to deliver them to the Russians. You just bury them in the Rocky Mountains. And the trigger is something that will set them off if the Soviets launch a nuclear attack on the U.S. You then tell the Soviets you've done this, and now you can dismantle your whole retaliatory apparatus, I'm assuming your only worry is attacks on the U.S., because they know that if they attack you, the world will end, essentially. Hence the doomsday machine. And you can argue that what we really had during the Cold War was a doomsday machine. It was just one with human triggers. It was sort of not quite as neat and tidy, but the basic logic was the same. If the Soviets actually launched a full-out thermonuclear attack on us, it didn't do any good to shoot back, but we will shoot back, and therefore they won't launch the attack. That was really the theory of the system. Now, you can question lots of parts of this. It's not clear that the amount of damage wasn't being exaggerated. Some people would argue that, yes, it would have killed a lot of people, but nothing like everybody. Or at least if we'd taken the right precautions, it wouldn't. But take the stylized version. So that's a doomsday machine. And if you think about it, there are a lot of things in the real world that have that kind of logic, where you commit yourself to do something that it won't pay you to do once it happens, but being committed makes other people not do things to you. Well, imagine that you're a big, tough guy, and you like getting your own way, as most of us do. And you can psychologically commit yourself to the strategy that when people cross me, I beat them up. And I beat them up whether or not it pays to beat them up. Because if people know that, they aren't going to cross me. They're not going to have to beat them up. Right? It's a workable strategy sometimes. And as long as nobody else is taking that strategy, you're in pretty good shape. But there, you don't have a monopoly on it. And one day you sit down at a bar, and you get in an argument with a stranger who's also a big tough guy, and he does not show the proper deference to your views about the superiority of the football team you're cheering for. And you know how you react to people who don't show the proper deference to your views about important things like football teams. And you get into a fight, and oddly enough, he doesn't back down. Because he's committed to the same strategy. And when it's over, one of you is standing there with a broken bottle in his hand, and the other is lying there dead on the floor. All right? That was both my and Earl's interpretation of what had just happened in this guy's story. And it turns out that the strategic situation we're imagining is actually familiar in sociobiology, in the evolutionary behavior of animal behavior. And it's what's called a hawk-dove equilibrium, or a hawk-dove game. And the hawk-dove game, the hawk and the dove are not kinds of birds. They're getting this term because of the political sense of hawk and dove, of militarist versus pacifist. So you imagine some species of bird, of which there are two variants, which we'll call hawks and doves. They look just the same. The difference is that when two birds see one piece of food, and they both head for it, the dove will back down and the hawk will fight. Suppose that there are practically no hawks. Being a hawk is a profitable strategy. You get food when there's a dispute. You get to raise more chicks. The number of hawks, assuming this behavior is hereditary, increases in the population. As it increases, the payoff to being a hawk goes down because it becomes more and more likely that the other bird aiming for that food is also a hawk, and a fight to the death or nearly to the death costs you much more than the bit of food was worth. So there is some equilibrium. There is some percentage of hawks in the population at which the loss from a hawk-hawk conflict just balances the gain from the hawk-dove conflict. And at that percentage, the payoff to being a hawk or dove is the same, and that's an evolutionarily stable strategy because now each of them is equally successful reproductively, and therefore that ratio stays constant. Make sense? Yes? What's wrong with it?
I'm thinking about the doomsday device thing.
Let me take the hawk-dove strategy. Does the animal model make sense as a way of explaining behavior, potentially? Now I want to claim that I'm giving a human hawk-dove strategy, that it's now bullies and wimps, hawks and doves. The bully is the guy who gets his way by making clear he's willing to beat people up without getting his way. And the wimp is the person who, faced by a bully, will back down. And if there are very few bullies and lots of wimps, being a bully is profitable. But as the number of bullies increases through whatever mechanism determines it, the risk of a bully-bully conflict becomes higher, and that lowers the payoff of being a bully. Now, the final step is it follows you can deter crimes of passion. Because if you're asking where that equilibrium ratio is, it depends on the cost of a hawk-hawk conflict. A legal system which says it was a crime of passion, so we'll lock you up for 6 months and then let you loose, the cost of a hawk-hawk conflict is lower than a legal system that cares. We don't care if you lost your temper, murder is a capital offense, we're hanging you. So the logic of the argument suggests that even punishing crimes of passion, which on the face of them are irrational, can, at least in this kind of a model, reduce the number of such crimes. So that was one way to start the argument. And this is what I'm now calling the economics of vice, where vice is being a bully. This is the description of under what circumstances in your rational self-interest to be able to think of as a bad person, as an aggressive person. Now, what about virtue? Imagine a world in which everybody had his utility function written on his forehead. Utility function is a description of what you value. And there are some people who are nice people. And what being a nice person means is that when you're in any voluntary transaction with people, you will act to maximize the joint benefit. So if you're an employee and you say, I could save the company $20 if I stayed overtime for 5 minutes, you do it. And if you're an employee and you say, well, you know, they wouldn't catch me if I stole this watch from the drawer, but the value of the watch to me is less than the cost of them of having things stolen, so I won't. That's the nice guy. And suppose your utility function was written on your forehead so people could tell whether you were a nice guy like that or whether you were an amoral person who would just do whatever benefited himself. The cost to an employer of hiring a rogue instead of a nice guy is higher than the benefit to the rogue. Consequently, the difference in the salary that the nice guy will command over the salary the rogue will command is larger than the cost of being a nice guy. Consequently, in a world where everybody's utility function is written on his forehead, it pays to be a nice guy in voluntary transactions. All right? Not relevant to beating people up, because that they didn't choose to be in that interaction. Right? My final step is to claim your utility function is written on your forehead. And it's written in somewhat fuzzy letters. But all of us are always giving a continual narration in tone of voice, face expression, gestures of what we're thinking of the inside of your head. It's harder to lie than to tell the truth. That there are some people who are very talented, we call them con men, at simultaneously running run process inside their head and faking the results of a different process inside their head. Most of us aren't. It's harder to be two people at once than one person at once. Consequently, for most of us, it's easier to persuasively be the kind of person who wouldn't cheat and could get away with it than to pretend to be such a person. Consequently, it's proper to be such a person. All right? So my economics of virtue is why you are better off being a nice guy. The final step is a prediction. Economics of virtue makes you a nice guy only for voluntary transactions. Economics of vice makes you a bully only for involuntary transactions. If you apply for a job and you say, and by the way, I beat up people who don't do what I tell them, you aren't going to get that job, not unless you were offered to work real cheap. All right. So the implication is that a society where a very large fraction of interactions are voluntary will have nicer people in it than a society where a very large fraction of interactions are not voluntary. Now, non-voluntary covers a lot of things. It includes being neighbors. Right? So if you're in a society where everybody grows up in a village, you're not very easy to move and so forth, it might pay to be a bully because, you know, then people leave you alone. And it's not like they need your permission to be your neighbor, and therefore it's not like you're going to get a bonus for being a nice guy. But it does seem to me an interesting prediction of that analysis. We're out of time. I figured since we had a little extra time, and I think it's an interesting way of looking at the world, which is part of what I'm trying to teach, I thought I would cover it.